Most of you listening will be familiar with the Emperor Joseph II from Geoffrey Jones's portrayal of him in Schaeffer's 1984 film Amadeus. Joseph, the enthusiastic if clueless musical king with no ear at all, where every suggestion is responded to by a vacuous "uh-huh," or a "well, there it is." Schaeffer's caricature was almost certainly extrapolated from Joseph's infamous remark to Mozart at the premiere of his opera Il Serai, "Too many notes, dear Mozart, too many notes," and a literate comment fed to him in the film by Charles Kay's Count Orsini Rosenberg. The film and the original play represent a heightened reality, like an opera. It was not intended to convey a sense of the real Emperor Joseph. Nevertheless, this is the view of him that has stuck outside of Central Europe. Joseph truly was the musical king. Through Viennese mayor Joseph George Perl, numerous Josephine theatres were erected in the capital, such as the Wiener Theater. Vienna would come to replace Mannheim as the center of classical music in the Holy Roman Empire and in Europe. This was the era of the first Viennese school of music under Joseph Haydn and Mozart. They would soon be followed by Ludwig van Beethoven and Schubert. Vienna retained this position of cultural hegemony, of dominance, until the collapse of the empire itself in the First World War. Joseph II had patronized Mozart's abduction from the seraglio, as mentioned, but it was the Magic Flute, which premiered shortly after the emperor's death, that captured an aspect of the idiosyncrasies of the emperor's reign. Joseph had his own Enlightenment advocate. Whereas Voltaire flattered Frederick and Catherine the Great, and Rousseau came to dominate the political consciousness of the burgeoning French bourgeoisie, the Austrian equivalent and advisor to the emperor was Joseph von Sonnenfels, a member of the Austrian Illuminati. On Sonnenfels's advice, Joseph banned the use of torture. Though beyond moral philosophy, Sonnenfels was a newspaper editor, prominent theatre critic, and a friend of Mozart. Through the influence of Sonnenfels and the creativity of the librettist Emanuel Schikaneder, the Magic Flute encapsulates a Masonic mythology. Joseph II's reign had moderated the Catholic moralizing zeal of his mother, Maria Theresa, who in turn had moderated the severe Catholic Spanish court culture of her father, the Emperor Charles VI. At once, Joseph wished to embody the Enlightenment zeitgeist that led him into conflicts with the papacy through his toleration and even promotion of secular ideals. His reign was spent in pursuit of a grand rationalizing, secularizing order, which assumed that the Catholic Church did not have the monopoly on truth. Such was his influence and his association with the term enlightened despotism, everything for the people, nothing by the people, that Josephinism has become a byword for the Austrian Enlightenment. Joseph's reign had reset the tumultuous relationship with Austria's Jewry. It had created the conditions for Masonry and the Illuminati to thrive. And yet, Joseph sought to bring the very forces he had helped usher in under control. The Masonic myth portrayed in the Magic Flute was a parody of the silliness Joseph associated with the lodges. He could only countenance Freemasonry as a rationalized, controlled, supervised, censored phenomenon, not something that could ever be used to check his aspirations for despotism. The irony being that his attempts to control Masonry was one of his few successes, as in contrast to his attempts to pursue order elsewhere, all of which unraveled. The circumstances in which Joseph came to power were truly novel in the grand scheme of the Austrian Habsburg history. His mother had ascended to the Habsburg monarchy through a diplomatic contrivance known as the pragmatic sanction. It is through the sanction that we begin to quantify what the Habsburg monarchy was, a composite of historically distinct, culturally diverse territories held together by a dynastic connection and a series of treaties, both internal and external. The fact that Maria Theresa was a female heir had made such clarification essential for the future. Had Joseph been born a year earlier in 1740, the point may have been moot, and Joseph would have inherited the Habsburg monarchy and the title of Holy Roman Emperor, resolving the conundrum of female inheritance, bypassing his mother in the succession. As it transpired, his mother would have to fight for her inheritance and that of her sons, and once she had won the inheritance for herself, her son would have to wait another 40 years. Joseph's father was eventually elected Holy Roman Emperor, though when he died in 1765, Joseph was elected to succeed him as emperor, but his mother continued to rule the Habsburg territories in her own right, maintaining the integrity of her lands. Her lands were her own inheritance. She held the pragmatic sanction to be inviolable, and Joseph would have to wait to curb his enthusiasm for reform. This relationship of unequals is a perfect demonstration of how superfluous the title of emperor now was. The power lay in the institutions of the Habsburg monarchy, not the empire. For Joseph to exert power, he needed to control or at least have influence over his mother's dynastic holdings. The phantom power of the emperor versus the hard power of Austria explains how Joseph's nephew and successor, Francis, was willing to jettison the title of Holy Roman Emperor in order to preserve the title of Emperor of Austria. Part of the power in Austria lay in its burgeoning and centralizing bureaucracy and efficient mechanisms at tax and revenue raising. Maria ruled through a Staatsrat, a state's council, led by a state chancellor with the responsibility to advise her. Though the state's council was contingent on the empress, Maria Theresa governed through her ministers, such as Haugwitz. She was a unifying figurehead as opposed to the autocrat Joseph would attempt to become. Haugwitz was responsible for reforming the myriad irregular military units across Habsburg lands into a professional standing army of 100,000 men. Meanwhile, efforts were undertaken to reform the Archduchy of Austria and the Crown of Bohemia, modern-day Czechia, through a united chancellery, the Hofkammer, for revenue control. These reforms had begun in earnest during the reign of the emperor's namesake, Joseph I, to create a united administration for the Erblander, the core majority of German Austria. During the reign of Maria, Hungary was left untouched by the reforms, as were other parts of the periphery of the empire, such as the Italian possessions around Milan, Lombardy, and the Austrian Netherlands, which more or less corresponds to modern-day Belgium. This was a provision, a gift, stemming from the Hungarians' loyalty to her in her fight for the succession. To be the Queen of Hungary was the most dearest of her possessions and titles, if the least efficient of her kingdoms. Similarly, the legal system was codified based on the existing precedents, and serf corvée labour were restricted, excluding Hungary. These attempts to repeal serfdom coming from the influence of Joseph, though Joseph did not care for his mother's Hungarian exceptionalism, it was clearly at odds with a rational, uniform scheme of administration. Such an incipient scheme or form of governance, here employed, or rather a science of administration, became known as Kameralism, from the German Kameralismus, or Kammer, meaning chamber, a pseudonym for state administration, which involved more centralized economic state intervention, you could say a precursor to dirigism in France, dependent on a professional bureaucratic class, with a certain moral standard, yet with concerns beyond material conditions to imply economic harmony beyond agriculture and manufacturing, while engendering trust in paternalistic, responsible institutions for enlightened administration. The bureaucratic structures, which at that time were likened to clockwork, were the engines for scientific, enlightened despotism, very much in quotes. In opposition to this spirit of this nascent, tolerant Josephine administration, Maria Theresa continued to target Jews and Protestants. Austria would remain staunchly Catholic under her reign. Only once Joseph reached his majority and the Empress was beset by her advanced age did her Catholic stances begin to moderate. Finally, upon his mother's death in 1780, Joseph II issued a patent of tolerance for the Protestants within the empire. Within the Holy Roman Empire, religious difference was legally established under the principle of caius regio, eius religio. The empire was diverse, but the princes had the ability to enforce religious homogeneity in their domains. Joseph was ending this practice, extending the legal diversity of the empire into the Habsburg monarchy itself. The cautious reforms of his mother made way for the wholesale reform of the empire, based on this rationalizing principle of uniformity throughout a formally composite series of states, rather than simply in the Erblande, the core possessions, and in the newly acquired Kingdom of Galicia-Lodomeria in southern Poland. During Joseph's reign, thousands of new laws were passed. Joseph spent most of his reign travelling and issuing edicts. Secular administration, education was established, church land was secularized. Joseph suppressed over a third of the monarchy's monasteries and reduced the number of nuns and monks, banned the Jesuit order, while marriage was brought under the control of the state. In his mind, monks who served no clear economic function were useless. As Austria had been one of the cornerstones of the post-Trent Counter-Reformation, a bastion of Catholicism against Protestantism, Joseph was accused of Protestant, anti-clerical, even Masonic sympathies. Joseph found some of his aims compatible with Freemasonry, though he was not a Mason, and found Masons as silly as he found monks superfluous. This zeal had accorded him the epithet of a Jacobin autocrat. Perhaps he was a Robespierre, in the sense he wanted to establish a new cult of the Supreme Being as a unifying symbol over this rational, secular form of administration, unity, of course, being everything to him. Or perhaps his reforms belied the post-belief pragmatism, even the atheism of a Bonaparte, who was willing to use religious structures insofar as it serviced his own power. Serfdom, of course, had been abolished in parts of the empire thanks to Joseph's influence. Corvée was replaced by salaried labour for peasants. However, there was a continued prevalence of a barter economy. Torture was abolished, the death penalty was abolished, while local vernacular and common Latin language administration was replaced by the use of the German language. In the film Amadeus, it is Mozart who is portrayed as the German nationalist, while the fictional Joseph dithers and defers to the preferences of his Italian and Italophile advisers. The real Joseph was the opposite. The attempt to codify in German appealed directly to a German-speaking middle class across the monarchy, including Hungary, the town-dwelling Bürgerliche. Though the promotion of German was on the basis of rationalizing the empire through a common bureaucratic and commercial language, it has been interpreted as an explicitly nationalistic aim in an age where nationalism, as we would come to understand it, was a new and revolutionary concept. Austria was German, and its destiny lay in Germany. The principle of a German-speaking monarch operating on the basis of everything for the people, nothing by the people, was perceived as democratic in the socialist vanguard or national socialist sense, a forerunner of the Führer principle. State servants were to be promoted irrespective of social rank. However, while this principle was established, Joseph still had to rely on a service nobility. Unlike his mother's policies, which were carried out in the Erblander, Joseph had extended his reforms throughout the entire empire, stripping the Hungarian Diet of its privileged position. Nevertheless, Joseph's attempts to abolish serfdom in Hungary were frustrated by the powerful Hungarian magnates who maintained their institution until the revolutions of 1848. Joseph has since come to be vilified in Hungary to the point that some will not acknowledge his as ever having reigned. For never having conceded the rights of the Hungarian magnates during the coronation ceremony, for he was never crowned King of Hungary. Ideally, perhaps for Joseph, Hungary could be subsumed into what would later become the Austrian Empire. The nobility resented Joseph II's autocracy and limiting their rights, increasing their taxes, while the peasants resented the interference into their everyday lives. such as limiting the celebration of saints' days, which, from the point of Joseph II, limited the productivity of his labour force. The periphery of the empire resented the attempts by Vienna to remove their autonomy, sparking a major reaction in Italy, in Hungary, in which he abandoned all reform, and in the Netherlands, which had broken out into open rebellion against him, the Brabant Revolution. Combine that with his military failure against the Ottomans, he died broken and exhausted, a self-admitted failure, as perhaps he was more ambitious than either Frederick II of Prussia or Catherine the Great of Russia. Emphasis on those two, because a fundamental aspect of Joseph beyond this obsessive micromanagement, this desire to take the grand polyglot empire in the centre of Europe and turn it into a uniform, homogeneous state, is really indicative of tragedy and emulation. Joseph II was a latecomer when it comes to the prominent monarchs of his age. Frederick II had ruled since 1740 in Prussia. Catherine the Great comes into power in the 1760s in Russia. He is surrounded by these enlightened, liberal, reforming monarchies who also have great martial prowess, and he attempts to emulate these monarchs. He attempts in many ways to surpass them, whilst while they are reigning and given free ability to do whatever they want, Joseph II is instead shackled to this notion of being controlled by his mother. His mother controls the purse strings, his mother controls the empire's resources, the army, and effectively she can loan them to the Holy Roman Emperor. The only consolation effectively of this, which allowed Joseph II some autonomy, is that Joseph II inherited the financial estates of his father, the Emperor Francis. Emperor Francis was a great businessman before he was a great politician, and that essentially gave Joseph the most amount of political maneuverability as opposed to the shackles and constraints put on him by his mother. But when I'm talking about this tragedy of emulation, those are the great people from which to aspire, literally called the great, epithets bestowed on him by Voltaire. But Joseph II, of course, never became Joseph the Great, as an admitted self-failure. Instead, I look at Joseph II and I compare him with, you can say, a comparative failure, which is Paul of Russia. Russia had perhaps the most similar situation to Austria in the sense that the era of the 18th century for Russia is the era of women, powerful women rulers, the two empresses Catherine, Empress Anna, and Empress Elizabeth. Peter III had attempted essentially to rule and to form an alliance with Prussia and had been deposed and almost certainly murdered under the orders of his wife, who would later become Catherine the Great. Catherine the Great, ultimately, like Mary Theresa, ruled on behalf of her son, who had a better claim on the throne in the case of Russia, and this would have been later Tsar Paul. Tsar Paul, when he does come to power at the end of the 18th century, like Joseph, has this rationalizing zeal to issue all of these edicts, all of these orders, of which almost all of them are countermanded, except in the case of Paul, he is actually murdered as a result of a palace coup led by his own officers and the army. But there is another aspect to this in terms of tragedy and emulation. In the case of Paul, he was seen as Europe's Hamlet, in the fact that his father was murdered and his mother had effectively usurped his throne. In the case of Joseph, for example, there is nothing quite so dramatic, but there are many parallels in terms of their personal lives. Prince Paul went on to marry the Tsarina Natalia, a very intelligent German princess who, in many ways, was intended by Empress Catherine to dominate her husband. She was incredibly intelligent, and yet she was the succumbing to tragedy in that she died very early. The same thing happens to Joseph. Joseph marries at the age of 19 to Princess Isabella of Parma. And when Princess Isabella is 21, she also dies. He marries again to Maria Josepha, but that marriage is disaster, and she likewise dies very young. It is a series of tragedies like this that ensures that Joseph will not have a male heir, and the descendants of the dynasty will instead be through his brother Leopold. This is a short segment from Wheatcroft, revealing, you can say, the tragedy of the emperor's personal life. Joseph was a man driven by powerful emotions. The loss of his young wife Isabella in November of 1763 from smallpox, the same disease that marred his own features, left him utterly devastated. They were married for 3 years. When 7 years later, on the 23rd of January 1770, his only daughter, the living evidence of their life together, died of pleurisy, after receiving her first and last communion, he had no one to whom he could pour out his grief. But in letters to her governess, he wrote, not as an emperor, but a distraught father, "I have ceased to be a father. It is more than I can bear. Despite being resigned to it, I cannot stop thinking and saying, every moment, O my God, restore to me my daughter, restore her to me. I hear her voice, I see her. I was dazed when the terrible blow fell. Only when I had got back to my room did I feel the full horror of it, and I shall go on feeling it for the rest of my life, since I miss her in everything." He told the governess, the Marquis, since I miss her in everything. He told the governess, the Marquis de Sales, that she was to have his daughter's possession, but he asked one favour. "One thing that I would ask you to let me have is her white dimity dressing gown, embroidered with flowers, and some of her writings. I have her mother's, and I shall keep them together." In some sense, this would pass as sentimentality. Like his mother, it was a consequence of their characters' passionate and emotional natures. If you were to look at his reign, and he almost styling himself as an Austrian equivalent of a Elizabeth of England, it was a comparison that Mary Theresa had attempted to use and encapsulate and identify her reign with the form of Elizabeth, that I have the body of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a king. In the sense of Joseph, it seems to go much further, because of course, while Mary Theresa was very successful in the conjugal department, Joseph II, of course, seems to embody the sort of post hoc, now de facto virginity, chastity of the Queen Elizabeth. He is now, having lost his family, having married again very unsuccessfully and only to be beset by tragedy again. He is now married to the Empire. He is married to the Habsburg monarchy. He is married to Austria. And so he sees all of his subjects like his children. And from his own perspective, it seems that his own zealous attempts to reform are almost an extension of a misplaced sense of love for his subjects. He shall be father for Austria, but he shall be a stern, paternalistic father from which eventually the children, the possessions, the domains will come to rebel. And this, of course, is also informed by his foreign policy. I mentioned tragedy and emulation, looking to the example of Frederick the Great and looking to the examples of Catherine the Great. However, there is a major personality element in Joseph that makes him almost it makes it almost absurd that he would ever contemplate trying to emulate the Frederican mold of government in Prussia, because he was fundamentally anti-war. This is a quick section by OK. In the middle of the years of Joseph's reign, while domestic opposition fumed inwardly, the foreign pot began to bubble. That Joseph's reforms were intended primarily to strengthen the state as an instrument of his own martial glory had been commonplace voiced by his contemporaries. Was this not Frederick the Great's notorious rival, who said on his final leave-taking with his troops that his first desire had always been to be a soldier? Yet, as so often with this complex man, everything is not quite as it might seem. Joseph's letters from the campaign trail of the War of Bavarian Succession from 1778 to 79 breathe a spirit of repugnance for war, a horrible thing, much worse than I have visualized, the ruin of so many innocent people. Foreign diplomats in the 1780s believed that his martial appetite was in decline. It is likely, as with his favorite general Lacy, that Joseph was always more than a military administrator, than a pugnacious warlord. A man whose travels had told him that Hungarian linen socks issued to Austro-German troops gave them blisters and much more of the same. He had, it seems, no master plan in foreign affairs, but had sought opportunistically to profit from events to consolidate his territories. Here, a key theme of Austrian policy was applied. the need voiced by the great Habsburg general Prince Eugene of Savoy to round off the scattered imperial lands. Thus, the Austrian Netherlands, even Galicia-Lodomeria, were seen as potentially dispensable, while Gaines and Bavaria remained the most attractive goal in the wars of 1778-79. Eugene von Savoy is almost advocating for an Austrian version of a Hadrian position. The Austrian Empire during the reign of Charles VI had become, in some senses, overextended, and was ultimately defeated by the Ottomans, forcing them to withdraw from the Balkans, which in hindsight historically was actually a very poor decision because of all the revolutionary upheavals that would befall the Ottoman Empire several hundred years later, and the back foot of which it placed Austria in its position in the Balkans. But this idea of taking the Austrian Netherlands and taking Galicia, Lodomeria, and seeing them as dispensable. Galicia-Lodomeria was an acquisition that Austria made during the reign of Mary Theresa, thanks to the partitions of Poland. It was a brilliant means by which Frederick could bring on side the Catholic Austrians to dismantle the Catholic Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth by giving Austria the richest and most populous possessions in the partition, while giving Frederick essentially the means to control the Polish economy by proxy, by cutting off Danzig and controlling access during the around the River Vistula. All this is to say that that was a great compensation, this vast land and the richest part and most populous part of Poland, for Frederick having taken away the province of Silesia, German Silesia and Bohemia, during the Austrian War of Succession, and having defended it successfully during the Seven Years' War, in which Prussia is saved many times by the miracles of Brandenburg. If we are to look at a policy which internally is to Germanify Austria, then it is only rational that Joseph II would look at Polish and Ruthenian Galicia-Lodomeria and Flemish and French Austrian Netherlands and see these territories fundamentally as expendable, as pushing the empire in too many directions which distract from its German destiny. So he seizes upon this issue in Bavaria, which is the possibility of him acquiring large, powerful, Catholic, populated German regions adjacent to Austria, and that would massively consolidate his position. However, this all again comes back to his lack of martial ability, that he is emulating Frederick the Great, yet also he is unable to really rival, let alone surpass him. Because Frederick the Great had imposed a new order in Germany by force during the reign of his mother, Mary Theresa, a system which is referred to as German dualism, Austria and Prussia. But Prussia's eventual ascent and unification of Germany in the 1770s, 1780s, during the reign of Joseph, was by no means a predetermined fact, or you couldn't even really conceive of it during that time, because during the reign of Joseph II, Austria eclipsed Prussia economically and in terms of manpower and landmass. To put this in perspective, Austria rivaled France in terms of its population. We're talking 20 to 25 million men during the reign of Joseph II. The reason Austria wasn't as powerful, if not more powerful, than France is due to the aforementioned composite and fractured nature of the collection of monarchies, as opposed to the one monarchy around France. Of course, France itself was not efficiently centralized or consolidated as later revolutionaries would hope, but the same situation existed to a much greater extent in Austria. It is something that Joseph II wanted to compensate for and resolve, and he failed to do so. So, as the significance of the title waned, which is demonstrated by the imbalance in the relationship and power between Joseph II and Mary Theresa, the future of Austria seems predicated on this assertion of itself within Germany, emphasizing this German character over the polyglot territories. Joseph II attempts this with the Potato War, with the War of Bavarian Succession. He attempts to surrender the Austrian Netherlands to the new Elector of Bavaria, while in turn that territory would be swapped over for Bavaria itself, allowing for the German core, the Erblander, to be expanded massively into the west, and for Austria to establish its complete dominance over southern Germany at the very least. However, why does this fail? Well, first of all, It causes huge anarchy within the lands of Austria because it's seen as Joseph II willingly prepared to abandon many of his quote unquote subjects if it proved expedient for his plans. You know, the contradiction of the emperor, everything for the people, but which people are we talking about? We're not talking about the Hungarians, we're not talking about the Poles, we're not talking about the denizens of the Austrian Netherlands. If these people are expendable, then the whole reform plan. This sense to try and impose a Germanic construct or superstructure over these lands was seen as a foreign imposition. This is something that his mother, Maria Theresa, was able to navigate with her policies towards Hungary. Yes, it came at the cost of massive inefficiencies within the empire, but it's better than having to overexert and cost vast amounts of resources only to create rebellion, as was, of course, the case in Joseph II, and then abandoning all of these projects. But what Frederick the Great had effected was a situation in which Austria could only gain this new territory, this Bavarian succession, by presenting it through force of arms, because this issue effectively became a question over Austria expanding at the rights of the smaller princes. Frederick the Great, who had expanded his domain at the point of a bayonet, had come round and said he was now the champion of the Holy Roman Empire. Joseph, this military administrator who disliked war, was now the bellicose party. He was the dangerous subverter of the international order, despite being Holy Roman Emperor. And Frederick, coming in during the Potato War, was the man of peace. He was there representing the stability of the empire, the German liberty of the princes. And obviously, Joseph's campaign goes disastrously. So there was no Hadrian-esque retrenchment of the territories and reconsolidation of the German core. Rather, the empire remains in this oriental position, more so during the course of the 19th century, as Austria is continually othered in the context of German unification and Prussian hegemony. So what consolation is there? The consolation for having been defeated in Germany is to expand in other directions, to actually go back and contradict this Hadrian policy, and to expand into the Ottoman Empire, the traditional adversary for the Habsburg monarchy. And in this aim, he is given a olive branch by Catherine the Great. Catherine the Great is expanding into Novorossiya, into modern-day southern Ukraine. She has annexed the Crimean Khanate. She's expanding down the Black Sea and attacking the Balkans. So Joseph II, even if he is not a great soldier, despite his own aspirations to be Austria's Frederick the Great, he will go and lead Austrian armies to ride the coattails of Russia's glory. And he can't even succeed in that. During the Russo-Turkish War, he fights towards the end of his reign. It goes as successfully as the reign which his grandfather fought towards the end of his reign, leaving Austria arguably weaker on the eve of the French invasions, the Revolutionary Wars, and ultimately in the Napoleonic Wars. The empire was weakened, it was vulnerable, and at the periphery, things were fraying to the point that the French could benefit from it. So, for example, in the Austrian Netherlands, the revolution in Brabant means that loyalty of the Habsburg subjects there is at its weakest at the point that the French are hell-bent on annexing it, which they do in 1794. So how can we thereby assume his legacy? I have this quick segment by Wycroft I'm going to read to cap off this episode, The Later Habsburgs. The man who had formerly been so vigorous and healthy showed the most unmistakable signs of rapidly failing strength. His eyes became weak and watery. He had sore legs, an inheritance from his mother and grandmother, erysipelas in the head, which obliged him, even as far back as 1783, to wear a wig, whilst before that he had worn beautifully fair hair, which had gradually assumed an auburn tinge, with two simple curls and a pigtail. His complexion, once so clear, was now of a reddish brown hue. The small pock marks looked as if deepened, and his hanging cheeks added to the length of his face. To what end had he sacrificed his health and his happiness? By his own lights, he sought the good of his people. Throughout his life, he had sought to make good arrangements, for which he received no thanks at all. In his last months, he wrote despairingly to his brother Leopold in Florence, "I am unfortunate in everything I undertake, and there is the appalling ingratitude with which my good arrangements are received and I am treated, for there is now no conceivable insolence or curse that the people do not allow themselves to utter about me publicly." This contrasts with the unswerving determination of his earlier years and his belief that energetic action would bring its just reward. His energy and the cascade of changes that he unleashed, the decrees and instruments alone, are numbered in the thousands, were in the service of enlightened ideals. Although Joseph had read very little of the great philosophers and practitioners of the Enlightenment, in contrast to someone like Catherine the Great, he abolished serfdom. He reduced censorship, only then to increase it. He restricted the rights and privileges of nobility, instituted degrees of freedom of worship, and created a bureaucracy of administrators and a secret police to put his program into effect. His former tutor, Christian August Beck, had written, "Sovereigns must consider that it is their task to promote the security and welfare of their subjects. As true fathers of the fatherland, they must never lose sight of the laws of justice and righteousness. As God's lieutenants on earth, they must imitate humanity's lawgiver, and never demand from us but what will be conducive to our own happiness." The young Joseph had given much the same thought in his different twist, in his Reveries of 1763. The notion, he realized, smacks of despotism, but without an absolute power, to be in a position to do all the good which one is prevented from doing by the rules, statutes, and oaths with the provinces believed to be their palladium, and which sanely considered turn only to their disadvantage. It is possible for a state to be happy, for a sovereign to be able, not possible for a state to be happy, for a sovereign to be able to do great things. God keep me from wanting to break sworn oaths, but I believe that we must work to convert the provinces and make them see how useful this despotism would be to them. In other words, he intended to force them to be free, much as his ancestors had forced their subjects to be true and loyal children of the Holy Church. In that enterprise, this despotism, this forcing his subjects to be free, this breaking beyond the shackles of particularism, of local petty nationalisms, of wanting to be Hungarian, of wanting to be Bohemian, in this case Czech, of wanting to be a Croatian or Pole or later a Belgian, all of these things run against this idea of a uniform administration with a nascent idea, perhaps, of a German identity, which is going to be wedded to all of these things. You can understand why all of these people would rebel against them, their particularisms, their ancient systems of governments, their traditions, the privileges of the local elites, the Catholic Church. All of these things are being undermined by a man who enters with such vigorous purpose, action, and ultimately is defeated because he is going against so many forces all at the same time. This is indicative of, you can say, the constant struggle of the Habsburg monarchy in terms of its nationality conflicts, in terms of the relationship between the core, the dynasty, and the peoples. The Austrian Empire will have peoples. It'll never have a single people, as indicative right towards the beginning of the Great War and how Franz Josef considers his peoples. Indeed, Franz Josef, you can say, in many ways foreshadows many of the failures, aspirations of Joseph, and also mimics his failures. And to round this off, what does Joseph II say? He says, "Let my epitaph be, here lies Joseph, who failed in everything he undertook."